through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
On the show, since we've had COVID and we've all been home and there's been no sports, you'd think that we'd just be so short of content and topics up here, but we are not, man. We are just blazing through with one hot topic after another. Here we go. The Seahawks have signed another running back, Carlos Hyde. We talked about him for most of the week, or not most of the week, the end of the week. He and Devontae Freeman, the Seahawks end up with Carlos Hyde, who's had himself a pretty darn good career. We now go down to Houston to Sarah Barshop, who covers the Texans for ESPN.com. Sarah, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Of course. How are you guys doing?
We're doing terrific. Now, we're looking at, of course, we have Chris Carson up here, and he's been the bell cow running back here for the last couple of years. I think we all thought that the Seahawks needed a backup running back, but is Carlos Hyde somebody who you think still has enough left where he could be used as part of the offensive scheme?
I think so. I mean, when the Texans traded for him last year, that was probably one of the better trades, I would say, in the NFL last year, just because of the way it worked out. Obviously, they lost Lamar Miller to a torn ACL, and Hyde came on, didn't know much of the offense, and came in and took over. And yes, the Texans have a good offensive scheme that has helped running backs in the past, but I thought Hyde did a really good job and showed that he can take as much on as the team needs him to.
Sarah, I was curious to get your take on Carlos Hyde in a sense of, you know, you say he was a great trade, but what did he bring to the table to the team that really stood out to you? And that Seahawks fans should be excited about when they found out that Carlos Hyde was being added to their roster?
To me, it was consistency. I mean, he came in when the Texans didn't know what they were going to do at running back, and every time they handed him the ball, he did something. I mean, he had some 100-yard games, which is something they hadn't had recently, even with Lamar Miller. And everyone talks about how he is such a physical runner, and he even talked to us last year and was like, trust me, if I get the ball, like, I'm going to go. And he took pride on that. So I think that you get a consistent, very powerful rusher, and I think he'll bring a lot to the offense.
It's interesting, Sarah, that you hear that Carlos Hyde had turned down an offer that seemed to be more than what the Seahawks were giving him, a two-year, $10 million contract. Why on earth do you think Carlos Hyde would turn that down from the Houston Texans after having a successful season?
I mean, based on the conversation we had after the playoff game, he believes he had done enough this season to earn a big contract. So I think the money wasn't what he wanted. Now, I don't think he could have seen what was going to happen to this climate, right? He can't make visits. It's a very different free agent landscape than we've seen in the past. So I think he took a chance, and unfortunately the risk maybe didn't pay out just in terms of the contract, because I know he wanted a multi-year deal. When we talked to him last year, he said he felt like Houston was home and he wanted to stick somewhere, but he just wasn't happy with the money offered in that Texans deal, and he thought he deserved more.
Sarah, what can you tell us about a little bit of his health history, specifically with that torn labrum? Did he play through most of the year? When did he have surgery for that?
Yeah, he played. I mean, he did a good job playing through it because we didn't know about it. We saw him with the wrap on his shoulder last year in the locker room, but every time we talked to him, he said he was good. And if you looked at the way he ran, you probably wouldn't have known that either. So I don't know what the status of his shoulder is now, but he played through it last year for sure.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you, in this situation, you know, with the Houston Texans right now, with Bill O'Brien, you know, there's been a lot being said about him and the moves that he is making right now. How is the fan base reacting to Bill O'Brien? Are they upset, or are they, you know, just trusting it and kind of in wait and see mode, knowing that they have a quarterback of the future in Deshaun Watson?
I think I mean, after the DeAndre Hopkins trade, if you looked at the fans on Twitter, certainly you would think that they all wanted Bill O'Brien fired. I think people are very upset about that move. But as to the added pieces, I don't know that they necessarily believe in David Johnson or Brandon Cooks, but I think at this point they trust in Deshaun Watson, certainly more than they trust in Bill O'Brien. So I think time will tell how they feel about Bill O'Brien, but certainly the Hopkins trade did not go over well here.
Man, out of curiosity, I mean, this has nothing to do with Carlos Hyde, but just since we have you here, what's the general feeling with Bill O'Brien right now, whether maybe among the public and among fans? I know you can't really disclose like what reporters feel about it, but I mean, are fans as perplexed? Are they angry? What's going on out there?
Yeah, I think a little bit of disbelief. Like I said, the Hopkins trade. Everyone, I think, was stunned about that. An elite player. Same if they traded you Devin Clowney. So I think people have started to realize the type of team Bill wants, and he's not afraid to trade these elite players like Clowney and Hopkins. But no, I don't think these moves have gone over well with the public.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
I mean, like, at some point, I guess, like, they would have to start losing and seeing the consequences of Bill O'Brien's actions.
Yeah, what would it take for him to even get fired?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think winning cures a lot of things, and that's the reason I think a lot of people, the team certainly would point to, look, trust Bill O'Brien. Look what he's done in the AFC South. Like, yes, they haven't had much success in the playoffs, but they have consistently won the division. They won a playoff game last year. Took the Chiefs, so it looked like maybe they were going to make an AFC championship game. So I think it would take a lot for him to be fired, just because if you fire him, you're admitting, one, that it didn't work, and two, it's two positions you have to fill. And you have a franchise quarterback who you know trusts Bill O'Brien. So I think, look, for all these trades, I don't think trading Hopkins makes the team better, but I do think that this offense is good enough with Deshaun Watson that they probably are still a playoff team or perhaps very competitive next season. And so in that scenario, I would find it hard to see Bill O'Brien getting fired.
Sarah Barshop of ESPN.com doing a terrific job covering the Texans in Houston. Thanks for taking a few minutes for us, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Of course. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Can you imagine if Pete Carroll and John Schneider were just like trading away one big name player after another? Just like,
imagine if they traded Lockett, Metcalf, got rid of Brown. Just why not? They just didn't really
think
like
about
them.
It. Think about it this way, real quick. Okay, we're having a debate about whether or not the Seahawks, who already have Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf, about whether or not they need to add Antonio Brown to that mix. Meanwhile, O'Brien down there is in Houston. He's got like one great wide receiver. Don't need him. Just ship him off. You know what? Let's get an injured, aging running back in exchange for him. That should work. I mean, it just goes to show you the difference. Like, we need to have some perspective when we talk about these different issues. It's like, you know what? Bill O'Brien's down there trading away one wide receiver after another, a guy who's like all pro, maybe one of the most talented guys in the world at his position. We can probably win without Antonio Brown up here. Hey, Jake, can't we?
Yeah, hey, yeah, for sure. But hey, look, here's the thing that also I think stands out to me, though, is that, you know, she said it would be very hard for Bill O'Brien to get fired. We look at that situation and go, are you out of your mind? Like, there's no way. Like, I can't imagine Bill O'Brien keeping his job after this next season because of everything that he has done over the last couple years in particular. And you're just going to... Sure, you might win the division, but you're going to be an early exit every single year. And so I think that there's definitely – we are in a much better place in Seattle, in a much different place. That is no questions asked. But also it's interesting to hear that ownership for the Houston Texans is basically okay with, you know, above-average performance. As long as they get to the playoffs – then Bill O'Brien has a job. Like,
B-.
I think that part
yeah.
is, yeah, if he's a B minus, it's okay. And for the Seahawks, I think that's kind of the angst of the conversation that we've been having all offseason is, what is the perspective or what's the goal? What's the marker? And I think for a lot of people, Pete Carroll, John Schneider, they've been hitting that marker. They've been getting to the playoffs. They've been able to give themselves a chance, right? In, you know, in March Madness terms, they've been getting to the dance, right? Gives you an opportunity. But now in that next case is, okay, well, where do you go from there? And is that on the coaching staff, the GM, or is that on the players themselves? And I think that that's an interesting point to be made. And it's totally different circumstances, but kind of a similar conversation in terms of what we're having in Seattle in terms of people wanting more and people being very happy with the consistency that you're seeing over the last 10 years.
Yeah, it sounds like the standards for Bill O'Brien are like the same as my high school grades with like, oh, so I passed? I passed. Okay, yeah. Cool. We're cool. I don't need the A. Full disclosure, you guys, I'm opening a water right now. Last time I cracked open a can, people were like, whoa, drink a little early. So I just have to clarify with the texters before you say anything on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. This is just a sparkling water. I need to defend myself.
What, they think you're cracking open like a craft brew or something over there?
Last time I opened a can, someone texted in like, oh, a little early, huh? I was like, first of all, it's after one. And secondly, no, it's water. Just kidding. We're about to get to four downs. I'm like, let's go. Let's get weird.
Yeah, if you've gotten to four downs or if we have gotten to four downs, you can do whatever you want. That's kind of the rule. Oh, you're drinking one of my favorites. I won't say what it is because it's a brand
new. I know.
Name, definitely underrated something I endorse.
Mm-hmm. Yuck. Mm-hmm. Sparkling water.
What do you mean,
no
yuck?
No chance.
Gross. All right, let's not get back into rainbow sherbet
stop
here.
Stop it. Get out of here. Yes, seriously.
Four down territory.
Well, if there was rainbow sherbet.
This is four down territory. Brought to you by MM Comfort Systems.
With Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
Marquise Blair was working out with Cam Chancellor over the weekend. What's the biggest lesson you hope he learned?
The playbook. Learn the playbook, young man. And I hope that's what Cam Chancellor was there. Look, I think this is a really unique situation in the sense that Marquise Blair was seen working out with Cam Chancellor, not just one-on-one, but like in a 7-on-7 setting. And I think that's really cool because now you have basically a DB coach out there who knows your system inside and out better than anybody, right? Truly one of the best to ever play the position in that system. And Marquise Blair is getting a chance to really work with him. I think that's absolute gold. And so if you're hoping for Marquise Blair to really grow in year two, that's the type of thing that you want to see. Blair, you know, being hip to hip with Cam Chancellor as Cam Chancellor is dropping knowledge on Marquise Blair. Because to me, Marquise Blair is one of the X factors for this defense if they're going to make a major turnaround for next season. He is one of those key guys, and if Cam Chancellor can help during, you know, COVID-19 and they're not in OTAs, but Cam Chancellor's able to help Blair, to me, man, that is a sight that I love to see.
I will have a follow-up question for you on this answer coming up in a few minutes. Second down. Hold on a sec, Stacey. I got to write down my follow-up question so I don't forget it.
Oh, all okay. Right. Yeah. No, take your time. I'll just start singing.
Yeah. No, just give me a minute here. Stacey.
Yeah.
Are the Seahawks really a great wide receiver away from being an elite offense?
So we started our conversation about Antonio Brown by saying, well, how far away are the Seahawks away from a Super Bowl? Well, really, we started it by talking about what Clayton says they need. But I think it was fair to say, hey, it's easier for them to become an elite offense than it is for them to, you know, ratchet up their defense and get that higher. And I still think that's true. When you look at where the offense ranked last year, they were eighth in total offense, meaning like yards and yards per game. Fourth rushing offense. Here's why I think that a really talented wide receiver three would really do a lot for them. But the thing is, maybe it's scheme, maybe it's protection, who knows? They were 23rd in pass attempts, which you have no excuse to be 23rd in pass attempts when you have Russell Wilson. Despite being 23rd in pass attempts, they were 4th in touchdowns, 14th in yards, and had the 3rd least amount of interceptions. So when Russell Wilson was called to pass, not surprising, he was incredibly effective. So the question is, does a wide receiver matter that much if you don't change your scheme? I think that it's clear in this offseason, the Seahawks need to look at where their strength is, especially with their defense ranking so low, and say, look, where would we rank in total offense if we were 15th in pass attempts, if we were 10th in pass attempts? You don't have to be 5th like the Chiefs were, but there's no reason Russell Wilson should be coupled there in the bottom third of the league.
Third down. Hold on a sec, little George. We'll take you out in about 9 minutes. Jake, what's one interesting stat that Stacy shared with the group over the weekend?
Well, there's actually a couple interesting ones that Stacy said, but the one I'm going to share with the public is it came from Pro Football Focus, and it said the highest graded quarterbacks, they just were too much. Yeah, we got to keep them off the air. But the highest graded quarterbacks, when kept free from pressure, in 2018 and 2019, it was number one, Drew Brees, who had a 95.4 grade, and second, Russell Wilson with a 94.9 grade when kept free from pressure over the last two seasons. So to me, what is that? Why is that stat important? Because when we talk about, you know, investing in the offensive line and what that looks like, it is very, very valuable to be able to put an offensive line around Russell Wilson that will protect him. And when you get those opportunities, he makes the most of those. And so you're really looking for a lot of these additions that they made on basically the center all the way through the right side of the offensive line to really pan out for the Seahawks. Because if it can work out, then you're going to have one of the best quarterbacks in the game really playing at a high level.
Fourth down. Will UW's home game against Michigan take place as scheduled on September 5th?
Yeah, I have a really hard time seeing this happen, guys. I think the University of Washington is one of those universities that is going to very much err on being conservative when it comes to the coronavirus and COVID-19 and the Pac-12 in general, because you have states that are more conservative when it comes to coronavirus. And so I see that this matchup happening between Michigan, I think it's smart on Michigan's part because a Michigan reporter says that the Wolverines are planning to replace that game on the schedule. Obviously, there's still a lot that can happen, but campus activities are completely shut down at the University of Washington till the end of July. So that's a lot of time where you're not able to train, you're not able to practice. And you're just going to go straight into training camp if you're a UW athlete. I just don't see that happening, even as an optimistic person as I am.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're going to, if they have a season that starts on time, the least that they're going to do is break it down regionally so nobody has to travel too far. But we'll see. Anything is better than nothing. All right, the question I wanted to ask you about Marquise Blair, because your answer was that you wanted him to learn the playbook. Is there a subset of guys on every team, they're obviously going to be young guys, that just have a real problem learning the playbook no matter what position they're at? Because if I think back to a guy like Ricardo Lockett, I think he's one of the – I mean, he had blazing speed, but one of the reasons he wasn't on the field was because I think he struggled a little bit at first, especially – with the playbook. I know that there are certain guys who just have a problem with that. Could Blair be one of them? And if so, could that keep him off the field?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that last year. That was the number one reason why he was not on the field, was because there was not a high trust factor with Marquise Blair. You saw him out on the field. You saw with your own two eyes the impact and big play potential that Marquise Blair has when he's out there on the field. But if your coaches don't trust you, then you're not going to see playing time. That's just the way it is in all sports. And it's none different for the Seattle Seahawks and in the NFL. And so I think Marquise Blair really has to show a lot of growth and a lot of maturity to be able to beat out a player like Bradley McDougal, who you know is going to be in the right place at the right time. He might not be as athletically gifted as Marquise Blair or have that possess that same speed, that 4.4 speed that Blair has. But so that's the thing, that if Marquise Blair could do anything for himself is to learn that playbook, to, you know, really have it down and to be the instinctual player that he is. If he can gain that trust, he will be the starting strong safety this season in 2020.
Is that really that hard of a playbook on Pete Carroll's defense? For a is he a strong safety, right? Yes. I mean,
I don't mean to sound like
a jerk. I mean, I don't know the playbook, but I mean, for a guy who's played football his entire life, is it really that hard?
Well, it's hard. It definitely is hard when you have communication. But I would say that the Seahawks playbook is easier than probably 70% of the rest of the NFL. So, from the standpoint of they don't play a lot of variety of different coverages. But I think one of the biggest things for Marquise Blair, and what is surprising with last year, is a discipline factor of being able to read your keys and being able to execute instead of just instinctually, you know, see ball, hit ball. But that's also one of the reasons why you drafted the guy, right? You drafted him in the early second round because you knew that he had this he had these instincts that you couldn't teach. And so that's why it was disappointing to not see the Seahawks give him more opportunity and more chances to fail out there on the field, because your defense was already not good anyway. So why not infuse a little bit of talent and let him grow learning on the job?
We've talked a bunch today about Antonio Brown and whether or not he'd make a difference. See, I don't think that however many more points you're going to score with Antonio Brown, I don't think that that's going to make up for your defensive deficiencies. I really don't. I don't think that you can say, well, we don't have any pass rush, so we need to add more offense. There's only so much offense that you're going to have. Like, I don't think that adding Antonio Brown necessarily equates to adding more points, A. And B, that adding more points necessarily means winning more games. Maybe you score more points against worse teams. It doesn't necessarily, like, you'd have to really prove to me that it would work out that way. That, you know what, we're going to be deficient in pass rush, we're going to give up a lot of points, but we're going to score a ton more too. I don't know that adding Antonio Brown means you're going to score so many more points in all the situations that you necessarily need it. That's the problem. All situational.
It is situational, but if you look at the Kansas City Chiefs and their blueprint for success, you could say the same thing about the Kansas City Chiefs in the sense that they outscored their opponent. No one is going out of their way to say the Kansas City Chiefs defense was any good. They really weren't. They had a couple key players in right positions. They had three good football players on their defense, and two of those guys were pass rushers. One was a safety, and that's where it came down to. But if you're a struggling defense, I think also getting ahead in games it is advantageous for you because it puts your defense in advantageous situations. It puts your pass rushers in advantageous situations because teams are down. They're trying to pass more. They're trying to come back. So, I think that there is an argument there that it can. And if you're not going to significantly upgrade your defense with elite level players, then adding somebody like him, I think, certainly gets you closer to having an elite offense.
All right, does it or doesn't it? We'll talk about that in the halftime show next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show, it's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Okay, right off the top of the show, we talked about the possibility of Antonio Brown becoming a Seahawk. John Clayton wrote an article last week about the Seahawks maybe having interest in him. If they did, they probably wouldn't move on it until like late July, maybe August. But Russell Wilson, also a fan of Antonio Brown, and we just debated the pros and cons of that situation. I mean, I said very firmly that based on the things that Antonio Brown has done that we know about and the things that he's been accused of, things I happen to believe, if the Seahawks went out of their way to sign that guy, I don't care what he's doing now and what he's doing to correct his life. I mean, that's the least he should be doing. I'm talking about him paying for what he's already done. Okay, and if you don't know what that is, I'll just read you a little bit of it here. This is from his Wikipedia page. On September 10th of 2019, Brown's former trainer, Brittany Taylor, filed September 16th. The woman accused him of sexual misconduct. So even if the case isn't as bad as that makes it sound, I have to believe that something happened there, something that he needs to pay for. And if that's the case, the Seahawks going out of their way to add him to their team, I'm sorry. I will lose a lot of respect for the team if that happens.
And I definitely understand that point of view, Tom. And morally and everything, I am right there with you. From a football standpoint, sometimes you separate those things out and you see what the player is doing now. And you look into what those punishments are actually going to be, and do they take you away from football? If they don't, then you're looking at one of the league's best receivers of all time. That's what Antonio Brown has done in his career. And so that's why it's so appealing and a temptation for a lot of these teams, and particularly I think the Seahawks right now. You add Antonio Brown to DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, and Philip Dorsett, you're looking at a pretty, honestly, unbelievable receiving core. So there is a lot of controversy that surrounds the player, and rightfully so. To me, it's one of those things where if it happens, you have to wait and see how it all plays out. And it's a curious move. But it's one that if they did make it and Antonio Brown was contributing on the field, I think it helps them win the division, helps them get to the Super Bowl because he's that talented.
From a football-only perspective, I would be curious to see what this team would look like with a really like heavy wide receiver room. It's something that I think might force their hand a little bit as far as their offensive scheme and philosophy, and might make them adapt just a little bit. I don't want anyone who's been charged or convicted with raping someone on this team. Obviously, all of this is still going through, I think, a state-level civil court, so we'll see how it all unfolds, but just hypothetically, it's not someone that I would want to cover, want to interview in a locker room. So yeah, that's my take on it. Although I understand very much the point of view that the Seahawks are one or two big offensive weapons away from being a Super Bowl team.
How many times have the Steelers been in the Super Bowl since Antonio Brown was with them?
None. But also, I think I don't think it's apples to apples in that situation either. You know, I don't think that you
It's not apples
say,
to
well,
apples, but the point in bringing it up is that a great wide receiver, even like Antonio Brown, does not necessarily take you straight to the Super Bowl. By the way, he was on the team that went to to the Super Bowl in 2010. He had a very, very minor role, but they didn't even win. But the point is, a wide receiver can only do so much. A single wide receiver. This goes back to that conversation we were having last week about the Arizona Cardinals and committing to Larry Fitzgerald as part of the core of their team. I love Larry Fitzgerald. I love watching him play. When you have him in the playoffs, that guy elevates like nobody I've ever seen. But when that's part of the core of your team, that's part of the reason. When you invest in wide receivers, that's part of the reason why you don't make it to the playoffs.
But Curtis, you're not talking about... You're not talking about just one player. You're talking about adding him to an already really good group of Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. That's what we're talking about here. And I think that's why it makes it so interesting.
Why would Pete
want to
do that, Jake? Why would Pete want to do that? Do you think he really wants to throw the ball around the place like they would have to make Brown actually make a difference on the team? You think he wants to do that?
I think
he wants to win.
Pete is... Yeah, I think Pete wants to win.
Okay,
I think
so you
that
think
Pete
he,
also
think
recognizes supreme talent.
I think it depends the kind of receiver. Pete has personally said he was asked his favorite players ever, and he said Lawrence Taylor was one of them, and then he said Randy Moss, one of the best players he's ever seen in person. He didn't say some other defensive back. He didn't say a running back. He didn't say anything. He said Randy Moss. I think it depends on the type of player. I think if Pete Carroll had a wide receiver room that was stacked with the kind of receivers that he likes, I think that he would entertain. It wouldn't be dink and dunk all over the field. It would be taking more deep shots, in my opinion.
I'm going to say this without actually looking it up. But show me a team that's won the Super Bowl that's just had star stud wide receivers left and right. Like one
what about
three,
Rob,
right down the line.
What about
you know
New
what,
England?
You know,
would they win as many Super Bowls without Gronkowski and Edelman? They wouldn't have won that Super Bowl against the Falcons without Edelman.
I'm not saying that you can't have like one good wide receiver, Stacey. I'm saying you don't need like Metcalf and a guy who could be. Well, never mind. I'm not going to say it that way. I just don't think he's necessary. That's all. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Is there something else you want to add?
No, I guess the only thing that I would add, again, from a football playing perspective, this is nothing. This is what we're talking about here. The other stuff that with Antonio Brown, I think we're all very much in agreement on that. But it's more so the mindset in which why that is even a thought is you look at the additions that have been happening around within your own division within the NFC West. A guy like Antonio Brown as a football player strikes fear into every defensive back in that division. And yes, I'm including Richard Sherman in that because he is that talented still, even not playing a year of football, he brings that level of talent to the field. So, that's why you can see why it's very tempting for a guy like John Schneider or Pete Carroll to add somebody like that.
All right, let's do one more thing here. According to Jeff Passan, this could be the most important week for baseball, at least since 1994 when we had the strike. Let's go ahead and roll that cut, Curtis.
I believe this is going to be the most consequential week in Major League Baseball in the last quarter century, dating back to the 1994 strike. Now the Major League Baseball season hangs in the balance, and it's going to come down to MLB and the Players Association figuring out how to split the revenue that they generate in 2020. And that is not going to be an easy thing to do, but as we have said on this show, on SportsCenter, everywhere for 2 months now, this is the moment where it gets important, and we're going to see if these two sides that have been at loggerheads for a long time now can come together and bring baseball back in 2020.
You know what? The biggest reason why I want baseball to come back in an 82-game form is to show everybody how much urgency gets added to an MLB season when you cut the season in half. Instead of 162, you have 82, and every game counts twice as much as it did before, if not more than that. That's what I want all of us to be able to experience together. If we don't get to experience that, I think that would be a huge shame. All right, the timeline is coming up next. Huh?
Hey, Tom. Half of 162 is 81.
Yeah, I was way off. You're right. My point doesn't make any sense. My point makes no sense.
You're fired.
Because it's 82 instead of 81, right? Okay. All right, we're going to do more math next. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe we'll get an update on the NHL next at the timeline. 710 ESPN Seattle.
This is The Timeline
with Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
Welcome back into Tom, Jake, and Stacey. It's The Timeline, reading you the top trending stories you're going to see on Twitter, Facebook, wherever. If you see any stories you want us to include, go ahead and tag us at Stacey Ross, at JTHeaps9, at Tom Wassel. We're going to go ahead and get started with two updates, the first on the MLB, the second on the NHL. This from The Athletic's Evan Drellich. Quote, the MLBPA is very disappointed with the MLB's economic proposal today, source tells me and Ken Rosenthal, calling additional cuts proposed massive. League offered to share more playoff revenue, but on balance, those dollars are small compared to what players give up. Players Association believes. So,
great.
Sounds like there's still about maybe a little less than a week of negotiating that the Players Union and MLB can do, but getting off to not a great start with that first proposal from the MLB today.
I don't think anybody expected this to get done at any point before the like the last possible minute of the deadline. It's not even, is it a soft deadline? Like, remember when Russell Wilson threw out the soft deadline? What was it, like 2 weeks and then April, whatever it was? Like, they got that done 11:30 at night or whenever it was. I don't expect that if this gets done, it'll get done a minute before that.
Well, Curtis, correct me if I'm wrong, but the deadline is just kind of like a, in order to have the 82 game season and training camp, they would have to have it done by June 1st, right? It's just kind of like a, hey, logistically, you need it done by this deadline if it's the kind of season you want. And if you go past that, then you have to renegotiate all over again because now you're playing fewer games.
Correct. And and there's a possibility that you're playing games into late November, early December if you aren't able to get it negotiated by the 1st and get games going by, what, July 1st or July 4th, whenever it is that Major League Baseball has it planned. So, that news doesn't really bode well right now, but hey, there's still, what, 6 days before June 1st, so hopefully they continue to negotiate here.
Yeah, and as long as those negotiations are happening and they are active, like, to me, that's what matters. And that's going to be the interesting part about it, is the back and forth that goes on between these two sides. I don't know. What's your guys' feel on this? Because I personally feel like if they don't get it done now, then the likelihood that they get it down in a couple weeks from now is just not going to be likely. And what a semblance of a season do you have at that point?
Right.
Because as Curtis said, you keep pushing back the season. Well, I don't want to watch baseball during the middle of the NFL season in college football. Like, that's where my attention goes to. The World Series happening. Yeah, I mean, they won't. So that's, I mean, do you guys think that there'll be a season
like it's
if
now
they
or
don't?
Never?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Tom?
I think this week is pivotal. Whether June 1st is a hard deadline or not. I mean, I don't think that they want to do a season that's going to be any less than 80 or 82 games right around there. So, and they need some kind of ramp up time, spring training. I mean, the spring training that they already had essentially is worthless now. I mean, unless they've been out doing the exact same things this entire time, which I'm betting most of them have not. That spring training that they had is essentially worthless. So they're going to need that amount of time. Yeah, this to me, it's now or never. I think they will figure it out, though. Like, as much as I kind of said before that I respect the fact that they don't get it done because COVID happened to everybody, not just the owners, not just the players. Like, this is something that everybody is dealing with, and not every business is going to be able to come through. Maybe not every sport will come through. Maybe baseball will be that one that doesn't. But I still have faith that in a week or roughly a week, whatever it is, that they'll figure it out.
Don't come through because it's your birthday wish, and therefore it has to come true.
It's my birthday wish.
That's right. And to me, I could respect if you just couldn't logistically put everything together. Logistics, it's too much, Tom.
Right.
It's too much, Stacey. It's we just can't get this all put together in a reasonable time and where it's safe and all that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about financials.
No, it's all financial.
And when it comes down to this financial disagreement, that's where I don't have respect for baseball in this situation. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out. I really am wondering what my attitude is going to be like towards baseball if it does fall through. I know I'll be invested and be very excited to watch it if it is going to come through here and we have live games at the end of June or July, whenever that's supposed to start. But if it doesn't, ah, man.
You'll be fine.
It's going to...
You'll be okay. You're an adult.
It'll hurt it,
you know,
I think.
You'll be all right.
I'm an adult, but I don't easily forgive.
No. going to our reporter here in the field with a little bit of breaking news. By in the field, I mean the studio, and by our reporter, I mean Curtis Rogers. NFL Commissioner Gary Bettman announced the league's return to play plan at 1:30 p.m. today. Curtis, what did we learn from this conference?
Yeah, NHL, they said, Gary Bettman said, starting off, he said, the regular season is over, so no hopes of resuming the NHL's regular season. They had about the same amount left that the NBA did, so it ends at about 65, 66 games, whatever. Bettman also says the remaining 24 teams, now there's 31 teams in the NHL, so 7 teams do not get an opportunity to play in the postseason this year. Those 24 teams will resume play in a tournament hosted in 2 separate hub cities to be named later. And those 2 cities, there are 10 currently in the running for that, for consideration: Vegas, Toronto, Chicago, Columbus, Edmonton, Dallas, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Vancouver, and Pittsburgh. So 2 of those 10 cities will get to host the NHL playoffs this year. And the playoff format, the top 4 teams in each conference will play a best-of-3 round-robin series against each other to determine the top 4 seeds. And then the bottom 8 teams will play to see who advances into that second round. So it goes from 12 to 8, 8 to 4, 4 to 2, 2 to 1.
Why do that? Man. Why do that at all? Why not just cut the regular season off and just seed the thing? And like have a couple
actually,
of... So if you have 12... Hold on. If you have 12 on each side, then you would need to have, what, 2 buys for each side or something like that? Just buy a couple of teams on each side. What's up with a round robin? What is this, a beer softball league we're doing now? We need to do like a best of 3? That's ridiculous. Nobody.
Oh, well, why not give a team a shot to still make it into the playoffs? I literally don't know what it means.
Why?
I'm not ashamed to say that.
Just take the top 12.
Curtis, can you explain why the reasoning behind it?
The only reason I can think of are those teams that are on the fringe of making the playoffs right now.
Right.
Who knows if they would have made the playoffs had the season resumed, and so this gives them an opportunity to still compete for a championship to make up for that lost time in the regular season.
And you never know. Look at the Blues, who went from like one of the worst teams to winning the Stanley Cup last year. Go Blues.
Yeah, very true.
So,
yes, I know that you've adopted them last year, Stacey, because of Lydia Cruz's fandom. But to me, I actually love this. Tom, you talk about cutting in half the baseball season and seeing the urgency that happens. The NHL, you're getting basically playoff hockey right out of the gate. And I think that that's going to be really fun to watch, and it's going to make it that much more competitive. And you basically get an extended version of the NHL playoffs. So I actually really like this. I think it's a very fair and exciting way to still give everybody a chance to win a Stanley Cup, but also not prolonging a season and drawing it out, you know, way too far down the line of their normal season.
I'm not really complaining because I don't care. Like, as long as we have the sport, we have the sport. But why clutter it up with that? Why not just start 12 on each side, have the East Conference in New York, Western Conference in L.A., split it up between 3 arenas, and then just go? Why do we need this round-robin nonsense?
Well, I just think it prolongs the season, I think, Tom. I think it would then prolong your season when you've already played a little bit. And then you're going to have a mini regular season, then get to the playoffs. I think you just get too far down the line. This is a way to be able to wrap up that season relatively quick, I think.
And then one very, very last update that came out during this segment with a little more information about that MLB proposal. This from ESPN's Jeff Passan. We'll just end it with this. He said the MLB proposed cuts to the highest paid players in baseball in its first economic proposal that was pitched to players today. Players in turn bristled at the proposal. There's a significant gap between what the league offered and what the players want. That's where we are right now.
Know your Seahawks. Who in the heck is Carlos Hyde? We'll investigate next. 710 ESPN Seattle.